Well, Sean, I see you're in your hotel room. I'm actually at home, but flying to Pittsburgh this evening. It is Thursday. Got a game six in the Rangers-Penguins series, and we may not have Sidney Crosby. We don't know that yet, Sean, but everything changed when Sidney Crosby left the ice with about less than 6 minutes to go in game five of the Rangers-Penguins series. And now I wonder if the whole series changed, and for the fact of the matter, the whole, you know, playoffs for the Rangers and Penguins.
Yeah, it's amazing, and that's what playoffs is about. I was actually having dinner with a friend of the podcast, Mike McKenna, yesterday. I'm in St. Louis, and it's 93 degrees here, by the way. So that's playoff hockey right there. But we were having a little dinner watching the game, and we looked down, and then we looked up, and there was a goal, and then we looked up again, and there was another goal, and it was crazy. And that's the beauty of the playoffs. The sad part is it came as the result of a really great player leaving the ice. And when I say a really great player, maybe the best player in the playoffs right now, Sidney Crosby was playing lights out hockey like he did in the regular season. And for people who listen to this podcast regularly, if they've heard me go on about how Sidney Crosby should be in the MVP conversation, he did not make it. He was not one of the finalists. I think that's somewhat of an injustice. He is what makes that team go. And he's what had made the Penguins go in a series that they probably didn't have a right to be in. If you're going to be honest, right? You're going up against the MVP of the league finalist and Shesterkin as the goalie, you know, high powered offense, a deeper team, all of those things. And Sidney Crosby willed a team with a third string goalie to a 3-1 lead and a lead in game five before everything fell apart.
And it's amazing that it happened the way it did, that as soon as he left the ice, the Penguins just unraveled. And they won't say that it was because Sidney Crosby left the ice, because, you know, they're not going to come out and publicly admit that. But at the same time, I got to think that that was just, you know, an emotional letdown to watch number 87 walk down Zamboni, you know, and if you're paying attention, you know why. You know, he gets hit by Jacob Trouba and they don't like the hit and what have you. But you see him going down and now three goals right away. Now they got one back 13 seconds later, you know, to make it a 3-3 game. But when you don't come out for the third period with him, that's also an emotional letdown. And the Rangers were much better in the third period. They got the early power play. They got a goal and they were able to hold on to that lead, which is something they haven't been able to do in this series, which is hold on to leads. And they were able to do it at that point. So it's amazing how it just turns. And now this series shifts back to Pittsburgh. And all of a sudden, the Rangers are looking at it and saying, well, if Crosby doesn't play, I mean, guys like Mika Zibanejad and Chris Kreider, who've been really, you know, quiet 5-on-5, in large part because they're playing up against Crosby and they're getting beat by him. Well, they might not have to worry about that now. And all of a sudden, well, maybe they can go out and play some offense now. Now, there is Evgeny Malkin. And Malkin is notorious in games where Crosby doesn't play for stepping his game up. He is notorious for doing that. So the Penguins are going to have to bank on that if Crosby can't go. But I just wonder if that, you know, that shift in the, you know, it really makes that big of a difference. Or are we going to say to ourselves by the end of game six, you know what, the Penguins experience just played out and that was it. And their experience won them this game.
Yeah. And I think that's a huge part of it. I think they have 48 hours to get their equilibrium, right? That, In the moment of the game, it was hard. Now they have 48 hours to regroup. Mike Sullivan has 48 hours to figure out a plan. And look, I think this Ranger team's been exposed to a degree, right? A little bit of the Emperor's new clothes, right? They, you know, we've been talking about them since the middle of the year when I had them too low in our Super 16 and got killed for it. And, you know, they steadily climbed, but they're not a good team 5-on-5. And then their goalie, for whatever reason, whether it's tiredness, whether it's a lack of defense, whether it's how good the Penguins are, whether it's playoff inexperience, he's been perhaps the worst goalie in the playoffs. He's an MVP candidate. He might be the worst goalie in the playoffs so far this year. It's a stunning fall from grace, and it exposed so many other warts on this team.
Yeah, we'll talk about goalies actually in the playoffs and the number that have played with Darren Pang, who's going to be our guest shortly. Darren Pang obviously does the Blues broadcast on Bally Sports Midwest, and he's on Turner doing a bunch of stuff with them in the playoffs. He's basically everywhere. You turn your TV on, watch a hockey game, Darren Pang is on the TV. So he'll be joining us, obviously, former goalie. We'll be talking about goalies. But Sean, you know, a couple of things there with Shesterkin. A, don't like his body language after he gives up goals. That's different from the regular season. In regular season play, when he was giving up goals, it was like he could just quickly move by it. And it was like nothing happened. Make the next save. His body language has changed when he gives up goals in the playoffs. He kind of throws his stick down. He kind of throws his arms up a little bit. It's a little bit different than what I've seen. And, you know, you wonder if that's just a confidence thing. If he's wondering, if he's fighting to see the puck rather than, you know, knowing he's in position to stop it. He came back and had a strong third period in game five. And I wonder if that can go a long way for him, but he is going back to what was his house of horrors in Pittsburgh for game six, where he played 3 out of 6 periods and gave up 10 goals on 45 shots. But to me, for Shesterkin and for the Rangers, it comes down to this. Playoffs are just different, man. They're just different. And you can talk a big game and you can say you're ready for it and all that. Until you get there and until you experience the highs and lows, the road crowd that gets all over you, the home crowd that gets all over you if you don't play well, right? The triple overtime loss and having to come back for that, two nights later. I mean, until you can experience that, you don't really know what it's like. And I could think back to the Penguins when Crosby made the playoffs the first time. They had no experience in that, and they got housed by Ottawa, right? They came back better for it. Maybe that happens here with the Rangers. Maybe the Rangers get by and they win this series. I don't know. But the playoffs are just different, and they're going through that right now.
Yeah, no, and I wonder what that first game took out of Igor Shesterkin. You know, 3 overtimes. He made, what, the 3rd most saves in the history of the NHL. Like, that was a shift that he put in. And I don't know that he's been the same goalie in the series since. But, you know, you got to love Pittsburgh, because I saw on Twitter the other day that they started chanting Igor's name at the Pirates game. Like, it wasn't even at the Rangers. They weren't even playing the Rangers. It was just like a Pirates game, and the whole crowd just started chanting Igor. It has to be intimidating. And, you know, what I don't like about it is the goalie gave up right after they had the 3 goals in the last game. Like, they're going. Huh. The Rangers are going. They're fired up, you know, celebrations. The crowd is going absolutely bananas, and it's all there for you. Like, you've done it now. You've put the Penguins on the back heel.
Yep.
You're ready to deliver that knockout shot and put them down on the mat for good. And then, you know, the Penguins make that last push. They wild swing. Hey, we're going to stay alive. I'm going to throw biggest haymaker I have and see if it connects and buy me some time. 13 seconds, he gives up the goal, building's flat. And the Rangers found their way back, but you can't play with fire like that. You can't. When you have a team on the ropes in the playoffs, you have to finish them. You have to finish them. You can't let them off the mat, because you're going to regret it.
And not to just jump away from the series, but we have seen teams doing that in the past that might have figured it out. This season, I think of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Well, really one, because you can't quite say that about the Florida Panthers yet, because they don't have the history of the Toronto Maple Leafs. But look, as we record this on Thursday, you know, we don't know. You might listen to this and the Maple Leafs could be going back to Toronto for a game 7. We don't know. But the way that they responded, Sean, in game 5, that was a different Maple Leafs team. That was a different storyline than what we have seen play out for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Also a different storyline than we've seen play out for the Tampa Bay Lightning, right? Tampa Bay, you're up 2-0. Past 2 years, they get up 2-0, shut it down. Game's over. Why even watch, right? Not now. They seem to be missing that edge a little bit that they had the last 2 years in their cup runs. But maybe the Toronto Maple Leafs, Sean, have found it.
Maybe. They need to do it one more time. I mean, the pessimists would say that they've put themselves in a position for an even greater fall from grace, right? Like,
there's a lot of pessimists in Toronto about that.
Yeah. Too. So, you know, look, hey, I grew up a Red Sox fan. So I knew every way you could possibly lose until you finally won, you know, and that's what it's going to be for the Maple Leafs. You're going to look at this game and you're going to be like, oh, they're in a really good position. They're in a perfect position to blow it. And until they don't blow it, that's going to be the major thought process. But look, this is a different Maple Leaf team. I think they've learned from the past. I think that Austin Matthews has grown up. And I mean that in the most positive way. Never, not that he was not grown up before, but he's become a playoff man. Like, he's a man in the playoffs now. Mm-hmm. He understands what it takes. He's taken over that mantle of leadership from everybody else on the ice. He shows them, except for maybe Jason Spezza, who I guess had quite the motivational speech that got them out of the hole they were in. And that's why you have veteran players like that. But, you know, maybe they figured it out, but they need one more win, you know. And I'm here, as I mentioned, covering the St. Louis series, and they won the cup in 2019, and they spent all morning this morning talking about how this is the toughest game, the closeout game, the not wanting to go someplace for game seven and leaving it up to the hockey gods, and how this is the game that really tests you. So let's see what happens when they're tested. The confidence is building now. Can they ignore it and do what they need to do, or do they keep on riding up and down the roller coaster and wait for it to come to a crashing halt in game seven?
Yeah. And you know, you brought up the Jason Spezza thing, and I'm glad you did, because when I heard about that, I actually thought about conversations I've had with you, where conversations we've had on this podcast, where we've talked about how the need for veteran players, like the need to have those guys around, the guys who have been around and have won and had some success in the playoffs, to speak those types of words. You know, you think about teams that say, we're going to go through a youth movement. You still need veteran players. Like, I think of the New Jersey Devils, right? Okay, they got a lot of fun, young talent. They got nobody to steer it for them right now. Toronto had a lot of fun, young talent. Nobody to really steer it. Jason Spezza's voice carries a lot of weight. And it still does, even though the Toronto Maple Leafs are older now and more mature, more experienced, have been through some heartbreaks. That voice still carries a lot of weight because it's coming from a very respected veteran player. All teams need that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know, good on Jason for doing it and understanding what his role on that team is. You know, he's not a guy that contributes on the score sheet as often as he did earlier in his career, but you know, those are the roles that you need on every team. You look, you know, again, looking at the series that I do, like, it's Ryan O'Reilly and it's Braden Schenn, and game five it was Tarasenko. These are all guys who learned through the cauldron of the Stanley Cup playoffs and reaching finals that this is what you do. And they turn around game five, and the series has been way more skilled than I thought it was. I thought this was going to be an old Norris Division black and blue battle, and it has been to a degree, but there's a lot more skill in this series than I expected. But the goal that changed game five, which is the pivotal game in the series so far, was a dirty goal right in front of Marc-Andre Fleury, a little deflection, pass off the boards, and you know, they're off to the races. And then Tarasenko just takes over the third period and scores beautiful goals. But it was a dirty, gritty goal that got them where they were, and it was by a guy who's been through the playoff wars. So, you know, it's really important, and it's so hard to quantify. You don't know until you put a player in that position how he's going to respond.
Yeah, and also what you have there with the Blues in the series you're covering, and it is a team that's been through it together too. Like, a lot of the core has been through it together. Pittsburgh's got that too. A lot of the core has been through it together, the good and the bad, right? I think of, you know, a team like, well, the Rangers, they haven't been through it together. They've got guys who've got playoff experience, but not together with each other. That is another thing that needs to happen too for a team to really have some success. Florida is trying to build that now, right? The Panthers are trying to build it. So are the Edmonton Oilers, but they're going up against a team that they should be beating. They're not currently as we speak. Look, the Kings have a couple of guys who have been through it together. Quick, obviously, Kopitar, Brown. I got to tell you, I'm floored that that's even a series. Like, it shocks me that is even a series based on, you go head to head, just go head to head. The Edmonton Oilers should be blowing them out. They have in a couple of games, but the punch back ability that the Kings have had, they've been counted out all season long, and they just keep fighting back.
Yeah. And, but at what point does it become concerning, embarrassing that every year this team goes into the playoffs and they forget how to play hockey, right? Like, look, I believe that I picked the LA Kings to beat the Edmonton Oilers. Right. And the reason I did, and there's two reasons. One, I thought that their middle was really good, and you know, Kopitar and Danault being able to shut down McDavid and Draisaitl, and over a long series, that would take its toll. And then I thought that either goalie that the Kings went with was going to be better than Mike Smith, even as well as Mike Smith played down the stretch. And both of those things have been borne out. And then nobody else has taken up the slack except for Evander Kane, who's had a monster series. The Blues, much like the Rangers, have lost their minds at times. They've let games get away from them. You know, they fight back in game five and, you know, they're losing. I think it was 3-0. It's the same night that my game goes 3-1. On.
Yeah.
So, and, but somehow they get it to 4-4 in overtime. And then on the second shift of overtime, guy just walks in, Kempe walks in and boom, bang, you're done. Like you, if you're a legitimate Stanley Cup champion contender, which is what the Edmonton Oilers should be, you can't lose that game. You just can't. You shouldn't even be in that game. Like there shouldn't be a game. You should strangle the life out of it. And they haven't been able to do it. And when does it fall on the core? Like when do the excuses stop and you say, we have these really talented guys, but they don't deliver when they need to deliver?
Well, let's see what happens, right? I mean, we got to let it play out. You know, you let it play out. If they lose in this first round to the Los Angeles Kings, it falls on the court. They take the hit. They have to. What does that mean? I don't know what that means, you know, but that's unacceptable for them. You know, they play. All right, fine. You lose game one. Okay. All right. You lose game one. Come back 8-2, 6-0, dominating this team. And then you lose 4-0 in game four. How does that happen? Then you fight back in game five, twice fight back, right? 72 seconds into overtime, it's over, right? Like these things, unacceptable. Let's see what happens. Let's not put the cart before the horse. But if it happens that they lose to the Los Angeles Kings, with all due respect to the Los Angeles Kings, because they haven't gotten any respect all season and they deserve it, okay? They do. This is on the core. It's on McDavid. It's on Draisaitl. It's on Darnell Nurse, who's not going to play game six, right? It's on them. And it's a referendum on what they are right now, which is a regular season team.
Is it an image-altering loss for McDavid at that point? How many kicks at the can has he had?
Yeah. Well, he's going to get a lot more, you would expect. But for now, it's... I don't know if it's image altering. I think Connor McDavid is so well regarded around the league for his individual ability. And there still is only so much he can do, you know, one person can do, but he's the leader of that team. So he takes a hit for it big time. He does. He has to take a hit for it. How could he not? Now, if they come back and win game six and seven, they move on. Maybe they roll through, you know, maybe you get to set up a battle of Alberta. If Calgary can take care of Dallas and it's an epic series. And, you know, maybe that's the image altering series for Connor McDavid, maybe. Right. So we'll see. I think you just got to let it play out, John.
Yeah. Well, we'll let it play out and we'll see what happens. And I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about next week when that's settled and we get on to the second round, but there's still a lot to talk about here in the first round. And we should probably get to our guest, Darren Pang.
We were able to catch up with Darren, talked a lot of different things with him, goaltending especially. So here's that interview with Darren Pang.
Darren, thanks for joining us. I know you're a busy man. Every time I turn on the TV, I see you somewhere. You're either in Minnesota or St. Louis or Florida. God bless you, because that's got to be hard, especially learning all the different teams. But I wanted to start with something that you really know a lot about and don't have to think too much about, and that's goaltending. And, you know, it's unbelievable this year, the number of goaltenders we've seen. I think we're on 26, and tonight we're doing this. We're recording this on Thursday. Cam Talbot will make it 27 when he starts for the Minnesota Wild. Do you have a theory on why we've seen so many goalies?
There's a couple, and I'm glad to be on the program. You guys do a great job of promoting the playoffs in the NHL, so thanks for doing this. And I, you know what, I think there's a number of reasons for it. Your number one goaltenders during the course of the year, I think they had to really empty the tank with the position so tight, or even the ability just to get into the playoffs. There was no chance for a number two because you need those points, so... you know, goaltenders that you see down the stretch like Shesterkin and Vasilevsky, they got played rather hard down the line. And then you go to other teams where you had been injuries to number one goaltenders, whether that be to start the playoff series, like a UC Saros would be a good example of that. And with UC Saros being hurt, then they go through two goaltenders. And then, you know, for the Colorado Avalanche, you get one injured in Kemper, and so he's out. So there you have a scenario that injuries take a place there. The St. Louis Blues and the Minnesota Wild, many thought that before the series started that all four goaltenders would be used, and who would even be the starter on both sides. So they chose Fleury and Ville Husso. Craig Berube makes a change before Dean Evason does, and I think that allowed the St. Louis Blues, if they didn't win the game or wanted to go back to Husso, that there was still a lot of runway there that you could still get back into the series, whereas Dean Evason went the other way and hung with Marc-Andre Fleury, and now in an elimination game is going to change his goaltender. The Dallas series, two number ones, two horses, they've been great. I think that series has been outstanding. So, I mean, I think for me, that's the difference. Also, the first rounds, usually you see a little bit more power plays, you see a little bit more offense, dot-to-dot plays, hard plays, really offensive-minded plays. And therefore, you might get a goaltender that just loses a little bit of confidence, and you can feel that as a coach that says, let's get a change here and get a little bit more energy into our net. And so that's something that I think a guy like Dean Evason is going to do for tonight's game with Talbot.
You know, and I think, Darren, this goes back, obviously, to the regular season. I mean, there were 119 goalies that played in the regular season, so now 26, almost 27. Now, in the playoffs, it kind of plays right along, but I wonder if, too, it also is a part of the position itself becoming much harder to play as offenses just become much more sophisticated. And the skill in the league is probably at a level it's never been at across the board before. So is it just that, too, that the position itself, whether it's playoffs or regular season, is just harder to play?
Yeah, and we know that in the history of the game, we've always had great offensive players. I mean, that hasn't changed. And I don't think the players of today are any better than the ones of yesteryear. But I will say this, that they get more room. And there are, you know, way more power plays on infractions that would never have happened back in the day when it was hard to get open and it was hard to get beyond sticks. And it was, you know, you're leaned on sticks a lot harder. You're held on to players a lot more. And so, you know, now I think you're right for the goaltenders. I mean, a good example would be Kirill Kaprizov's goal in game number 5 in Minnesota. I mean, to take the puck from a backhand to a forehand and go under the crossbar and in on the short side is amazing in a limited amount of space. Tarasenko counted with some great shots of his own. But the fact is, it's no longer a straight line game. You don't go down the right wing and put your head down and take a slap shot, you know, or the left side. You know, or a high shot in the slot. You know, now it's goal line to slot to in the net. It's dot to dot and in the net, or at least makes you really, really work, and your legs are burning. I mean, trust me when I say your hamstrings and your quads in certain sequences, let alone power plays against, just burn. And once that starts happening, mentally you make mistakes because you can't be as focused when fatigue sets in. So, yeah, I believe it's a real hard game to play in for the goaltender. And give the shooters credit, the systems credit, and the goaltenders, even though they make so many magnificent saves, you know, during the course of a game or a series, you're just flat out going to get beat.
Before we go around the league, you mentioned Kaprizov, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on him. You know, he scored the two goals in game 5, and I tweeted at one point that I don't know that they would make the top 5 highlight reel of his game. There were literally 8 or 9 times where I sat in the press box and went, oh my God, when he had the puck, whether it's stick handling or spinning off of somebody or even playing physical, like to see him for a 5-game run back to back to back has really highlighted who he is as a player. And I think even at 47 goals, he's somewhat underrated. I'm curious what your thoughts have been on him.
I'm a huge fan. I could watch him play every day. I'd pay money to go see that guy play. And I mean, the best compliment today came from, you know, Craig Berube, the opposition coach. And you know, the Chief doesn't throw around compliments, you know, freely, because he expects players to play a certain way all the time. But what he said today, he's got a motor. That guy's got an engine. That guy doesn't stop. I mean, you know, like, let's face it. Some guys have different instincts. Some guys are great shooters that are kind of calm. You know, the puck gets them, boom, it's in the net. Some guys go a million miles an hour and don't do anything. You know, some guys, when the going gets tough, they don't want to get on the inside. They want to stay way out on the outside. And we know at playoff time, you can't score goals that way. But Kirill Kaprizov is everything. He's a total package, and he drives the game. And I'm just so impressed. Not only the goal scoring and the highlight stuff. I mean, the back checking, the shot blocks, the tenaciousness on the puck on the forecheck. I mean, he just absolutely does it all. It's fun to watch. We should appreciate this time with Kirill Kaprizov.
Yeah, he is a heck of a player. All right, I want to go around the league with you, as Sean mentioned. So we'll talk about another terrific player, Sidney Crosby, right? So that's the series I've been covering, Darren, Pittsburgh and the Rangers. And Sidney Crosby has been the best player on the ice, as he typically is, but it's like he rewound the clock back to 2016, 2017, the way he's been playing. They have a lead. He leaves the game last night, game five, and the Pittsburgh Penguins give up three goals in less than 3 minutes. They get one back, but they lose the game, and now we don't know about Sidney Crosby playing in game six. It's kind of ridiculous to ask how big of an impact would it be if he doesn't play, but I wonder if you think they kind of lost a little bit there because Crosby went out, and do the Penguins have enough to withstand it without Crosby, since he has been a motor for them all season long? You know, it hasn't been a Malkin season. It's been a Crosby season.
It absolutely has been a Sidney Crosby season. And I don't know where they'd be without Sidney Crosby. I know their, you know, coaching staff has done a phenomenal job. I think Mike Sullivan is, you talk about underrated, you know, players in the league or goaltenders in the league, but underrated coaches is Mike Sullivan. So he's done a phenomenal job. But, you know, when that happens and you lose a player that's a top player, that's your number one centerman, that does all the work on both offensively and defensively, then you need players to absolutely step it up. And, you know, I'm not saying that those players aren't capable of stepping it up, but for whatever reason, that departure left too big of a hole. I mean, I think that'd be the disappointment of the entire team. What could we all have done to pick up the slack of 2 or 3 minutes? I mean, that's basically what it boils down to. And at the end of the day, it wasn't enough. And so the reason why the Pittsburgh Penguins are so highly regarded is because of their center ice position. When you can go down and you go Crosby, Malkin, and Carter, if one of them were to get hurt, then you still have two horses. And so for that to happen and for it to dissolve so quickly in the game against the New York Rangers in a series in which you know your number one centerman and your number one player and one of the best players in the world is injured and you don't know how long it's going to take for him to come back, you want to close out a series so that you get rest going into the next one. That's what winning the Stanley Cup is all about, the timeliness of closing out a series versus extending a series and giving the other team life. And now the Rangers may have that life. And so hopefully Sidney's going to be okay.
Do you think Florida's found the answer? You've seen him play in this playoffs, and it was a little dicey at the beginning. You know, they had some trouble with Washington, and even as late as game four, they almost lost and they had to win in overtime. Do you think they've found the answer to be the team that they were in the regular season in the playoffs?
Well, I wouldn't have said that in a second. They're down to 3-0. I mean, you know, 3-0. I mean, you know, that should be enough to finalize things. But the Panthers, did they not lead the league in come from behind victories all year? I think they did.
Yeah, no, they set a record.
Set a record. I mean, so there's something inside that locker room that's spectacular. That resilience that we will, you know, the harder it gets, the better they come back and play. So have they figured it out? I don't think you figure anything out in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And the minute you do, you probably get burnt right in the rear end. So I would say no, but I do say that they figured what it takes to come back and what it takes to not give up in a game, whether you win it or lose it when you're down 3-0, to come back and to make a mark and put a dent in a team and really suck the life out of the will of another team. I think that's what it's all about. And that's what makes Florida so dangerous, is they can almost tease you and then bang, then they punch you in the nose and they come back and you're left wondering what the heck just happened. And that's obviously what they did again against the Washington Capitals.
If we've had one series in this playoffs that have been more like traditional playoff hockey, it's Calgary-Dallas. And you mentioned before that, you know, you're fascinated. You love that series. It's been 18 goals scored in 5 games. That's it. I mean, it goes so far against what we have seen in the playoffs and throughout the regular season with offense being up. What do you love about that series?
Well, I love talking to Daryl before a game. I think, like I do. I was, You know, I was a teammate. Then he was my assistant coach when he retired. And then he was my head coach in Indianapolis when we won a Turner Cup together. And there's nothing like talking old school hockey with Daryl Sutter. And you know that when you're watching a playoff series, you know, with Calgary, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get some tweaks. You're going to get some gamesmanship. You're going to get a team that's going to play in direct lines, and there'll be no swooping, and there'll be, you know, every opportunity you have to finish a check, you have to finish a check. And by the time a 7-game series ends, that if you've won it, the other team's D is felt the pain of the series, and if you've lost it, you haven't done well enough. And so the series itself, I mean, Calgary made some good adjustments, you know, going into game four, and they played just an incredible game and put so much pressure on Jake Ottinger, who was the first, second, and third star for me in that game, and all the pressure on Johnny Gaudreau and Matthew Tkachuk are the top players on the Calgary Flames. It's like, wait a second, there is a goalie at the other end that is making spectacular saves. That glove save on Tyler Toffoli was one for the ages. Stretching to his left, totally robs a great goal scorer, and that's basically what I like about that series. And people that thought at the beginning, or what I at least read before I entered that series in Dallas, because I did not do games one and two in Calgary, but I watched them, that there was some boredom to that series, I laughed. I mean, honestly, if I was drinking a glass of red wine, I would have choked all over myself, because there was nothing boring about anything. End-to-end action, great scoring chances, finishing checks. I mean, I don't mind 1-0 or 2-0 games. When there's exchanges on the rush like these two teams have had, I think that's great hockey. 7-2 hockey with 9 power plays doesn't throw me one bit. But that kind of hockey between Calgary and Dallas, that's what gets me excited for the playoffs.
Well, Darren, we all know there's no red wine during the playoffs, so that wouldn't have happened.
That's exactly right. You're right about that. But I said hypothetically if I did.
But there's, as we record this, and it might get added to tonight with the number of game sixes, but as we record this, there's only one team that's advanced, and it's the Colorado Avalanche, and they did it rather easily against Nashville, who was without their number one goalie, like you mentioned, but still kind of steamrolled them. They're getting some rest, and they'll get a battered Blues team or a battered Wild team that has to go 7 to win. In the process of beating Nashville, Cale Makar had a pretty special series, to the point where Nathan MacKinnon said he's the best player in the league right now. Is that a statement you can get behind?
Oh, I can absolutely get behind that. And I believe that he will challenge for the first Hart Trophy for a defenseman past Chris Pronger. So it hasn't happened enough, but his game overall is different than other offensive-minded defensemen in the league. He doesn't get all his candy, I like to call it, on the power play. He gets it at 5-on-5. He's become a penalty killer. He's become an overall, all well-rounded defenseman that can defend, that can hit. And when he gets the puck, he just makes such great decisions. And when he gets the puck in the offensive zone, there's nobody else I'd rather take than him. He's that good. The other thing about that whole series is the Nashville Predators will kick themselves for basically losing their last game the way that they lost it to Arizona. And it cost them. It cost them what Daryl Sutter said, 8 days of hockey. And I think it was 7 days of a wasted time. And that's a shame, because they're a good team and they've had a good season and they had some really good moments. And I know their number one goaltender was nicked up, but when they look back at it, I think they've got to look back at a 3-goal lead against the last place team that they lost and ended up having to play the Colorado Avalanche. But going back to Makar, I'm not sure if he's going to win it this year. I think the overall play of Roman Josi on a team that's just not as stacked as what the Colorado is, it might be Yossi's turn to win his second. But after that, you can just mark down number 8, number 8, number 8, and number 8, Cale Makar, for that trophy. I don't see anybody beating him out.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And yeah, Daryl overestimated. He said 8. It was 7 days. That's all it took for the Colorado Avalanche. Pretty remarkable series for them. But let's stick with that trophy. The big one, which you said he could win the Hart Trophy, Makar. He's not going to win it this year. But Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, and Igor Shesterkin are the finalists for the Hart Trophy. Who's got your vote?
Mm-hmm. Austin Matthews got my vote. As good as Shesterkin was, and maybe it leans towards Shesterkin, based on the fact that we are seeing it now that maybe they're not the defending team that we thought they were, disguised you know, greatly by his magnificent season. But for me, in the pressure-filled city of Toronto, to score 60 goals, to play it, you know, to play an overall game, that's just my opinion. I would lean towards Auston Matthews as the Hart Trophy winner.
And he's continued right into the playoffs. I mean, he's carried that
Toronto. I think he's better. Yeah. Honestly, I think he's better. I think that last performance was one for the ages after the first period. I mean, that's the way you play hockey. And maybe the light bulb's gone off for that whole team. Maybe it's gone off for Nylander, who had a tough time earlier on a bad back check. But, you know, you don't just win hockey games by throwing your sticks on the ice and playing on the perimeter. And that's what Toronto has basically done and not defended. Well, he showed them what this league is all about and what a seven-game series is all about by the way he played and the way he handled players and the way he forechecked and the way he did everything great. It was fun to watch. It was a one-man wrecking crew.
You know, look, you've been around a long time. You know how Lou Lamoriello cycles through coaches. Did this one catch you by surprise or, you know, in hindsight, should we have seen it coming?
No, this caught me by surprise. When it scrolled down my phone, you know, news from the NHL that Barry Trotz had been fired, I literally looked at it again, and then I looked at it again, and I happened to be doing a TNT game with Butch Goring, and he looked at me because we were in a press. I think we were in the press conference when it happened, and I looked at him and I said, "This can't be true, can it?" And you know, I mean, yeah, shock. I mean, Barry's just a phenomenal coach, as we well know. I think the whole system that was played got hamstrung by the fact that there was some lacking in transportation players, if I can put it that way. I mean, defensemen that can get the puck up the ice. COVID, you know, and their schedule was terrible. I mean, you know, but going back to the way the forecheck goes and the way that they play, it's hard to do that when you have a harder time getting the puck up the ice. So without, you know, Devon Taves, a big part of that. Nick Leddy was a big part of that. Because of cap restrictions, you know, those players had to be moved. But at the end of the day, I really think that hurt the system of Barry Trotz. So he's a great coach, and wherever he ends up, if he ends up somewhere at all or if he just takes a break from the game of hockey, he's a great person, treats you well, and always has his teams well-prepared and well-respected.
Well, Darren, you're a great announcer, and you hold all those same traits, and we thank you so much for joining us, and I'm looking forward to you being a constant companion every time I turn on the TV for the rest of the playoffs. I learn something new every time you speak.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. Thank you. And it's just great to be around locker rooms again and seeing people again and feeling the buzz of the crowd. And, I mean, that's what we greatly missed during COVID and the break. So thank you for having me on, and anytime, guys.
Great stuff there from Panger. Real happy we were able to get him on, Sean. I mean, he is a very busy man like us. We're busy in the hockey world. So, you know, I mean, but he is busy. He's on your TVs everywhere. And let's stick with something we were talking about there. Barry Trotz. I agree, as what Panger said, like when that came across, I was stunned. Like, but I think I was stunned because I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind that Barry Trotz wouldn't be the coach of the Islanders the next year. But as I digested the information a little bit, my stun or shock kind of wore off because this is what Lou Lamoriello does, you know? And there's a lot of different things here. Barry Trotz was entering the last year of his deal. Did Barry want an extension? Did Lou Lamoriello and the Islanders not want to give it to him? Remember, Barry went through this with the Washington Capitals, right? Last year, never got the extension. Did Lamoriello say, you know what? Your voice isn't what it was for us any longer, which is what he said publicly. And that's it. We're done. Moving on to the next coach. There's a lot of different ways to dissect it. With Lou Lamoriello, you're really not going to know everything for certain. But my shock wore off as I digested the information and really analyzed it and thought about it.
Mine hasn't worn off at all. First of all, I looked at my phone and tried to make sure it wasn't April 1st. That was the first question. And then
I think we all did that. I think we all did that.
And then the way I look at it is, who's better, right? You're going to get rid of your coach. You want an upgrade. Who's an upgrade on Barry Trotz?
I don't know that they're looking at it that way, though. And I understand the point of view that you're looking at it, that prism you look at it from. I think Lou is looking at it from the prism of coaches have a shelf life. Why wait too long? You don't want to be on the wrong side of it. So you cut it short. You cut their shelf life short rather than extending it and having it really backfire on you. Now, is it going to backfire? I don't know. Be honest with you, look, I look at this team and I say, Barry got the most out of it. You know, he got this team that doesn't have a great offense to back-to-back Eastern Conference Finals in very difficult situations both times. This season, long extended, I don't want to call it a road trip, but all those road games to start before they open the home building, they come back, they got COVID. Yeah, it was a mess for a while there for the Islanders. They got going in the second half of the season. They got playing in the second half of the season. They were better in the second half of the season. So it can't be on performance. It cannot be on performance. I think he got the most out of it. Whereas you look at the team, it's general manager's job to get them speed on the back end. They didn't have that. You know, it's the general manager's job to get them an extra score. They didn't have that. You're right. So it can't be about performance. Were the players tuning him out? This came after all the exit interviews. Were there comments in the exit interviews about Barry Trotz and the voice and how it's not working? Were they coming from important players on the team? Were they coming from, you know, leaders on the team? We don't know, but it can't be performance because he did the most I think he possibly could with this team.
And let's not forget they were done. And then 3 weeks left in their season, we're like, oh, could the Islanders make it all the way back?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
There was everything against that team. You know, just go away. Don't worry about it. Next year's coming. Like, and they didn't. Like, and to me, that's a testament to the coach. Like, he got them to play under the most adverse of circumstances. And you talk about shelf life, and there is a shelf life for certain coaches in the NHL. You know, a guy like Mike Babcock has a shelf life. A guy like Mike Keenan has a shelf life. Like, these are guys who are able to jump in, prod a team, but after a while, you're like, I don't want to listen to this guy anymore. Barry Trotz, how long did Barry Trotz coach in Nashville?
Yeah, no, shelf life's not a part of it for him.
He is fair. He's not demeaning. He's positive. He brings out the best in his teams. Like, if you can't, as a player, if you can't play for Barry Trotz, it might be on you. You know, I mean, all he's done since he took Nashville from an expansion team to a team that could make the playoffs, all he's done since then is win. And, you know, I think there'll be 10 suitors for him. Teams that already have coaches will be thinking about, is this an upgrade? And that, to me, that's, again, what you do when you make a coaching change is you say, the guy I'm going to bring in, is he better? And I literally can't think of a person in the coaching ranks that I would go and tap on a shoulder and say, this guy's better than Barry Trotz for my team.
The only thing that disappoints me with your shock and surprise is that, how long have you known Lou Lamoriello?
No. Since 1993, Dan.
Right. So why are you shocked or surprised at anything he does?
Because I'm gullible. and you know, maybe he's right. Maybe Lou's right, and he's proven me wrong more times than I can count. And, you know, he's a far smarter hockey mind than I am. I don't understand it, but it's the same with the Devil coaches. Like, I felt the same way about Jacques Lemaire. Like, who's going to be a better coach than Jacques Lemaire? He had won cups. He was positive. He did all the things that a team needed to do. And Lou ended up being right. Like, he went and won other cups without him. So I guess you do let it play out. But my original reaction was one of befuddlement.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're a general manager who's won the Stanley Cup 3 times in 8 years with 3 different coaches, you feel you can cycle through coaches and still have success. And that's exactly what Lou Lamoriello did from 95 to 2003 with the Devils, with Jacques Lemaire, Larry Robinson, and Pat Burns. But you brought it up. Barry Trotz is going to have a lot of suitors. Even teams with coaches now have to be looking over their shoulders. There's obvious candidates, right? I mean, Winnipeg is the most obvious. He's from about 200 miles from Winnipeg. He's a Manitoba guy. That's a team with a Barry Trotz coming in to coach, and maybe a few upgrades here and there on their on their roster, that's a team ready-made, right? It's a team that's ready-made to go. We don't know yet as we record this what's going to happen with Toronto or Florida. But if those teams end up blowing it and lose, I mean, do they make changes? Ready-made teams, right? I mean, that's where I think if I'm Barry Trotz, I'm not looking at going in somewhere and, you know, having to put in 3-4 years just to get the team to the playoffs. You know what I mean? I think he's beyond that now. I think he'd rather go somewhere that has got a bit of a more of a ready-made atmosphere. That's also a quality organization. He's come from stable organizations, and although the instability might have gotten fired, but either way, I don't see Chicago in his, you know, in for him. I don't see New Jersey in for him. Detroit, maybe because of the stability of Steve Yzerman, right? Philadelphia, I don't see that either right now. I just think it's too unstable. Winnipeg makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, maybe. And Winnipeg reminds me a lot of Nashville.
Like, yeah.
They're sister teams in the NHL, like very similarly run, you know, the same kind of feel in market, the whole thing. And I'm sure going home has some allure, but maybe Barry doesn't want to coach for a while. It's a hard living. I mean, the guy who left Winnipeg didn't want to coach, you know, it had become too much. So, you know, and that's Paul Maurice, and that's, you know, one of the people that they talk about maybe coming to the island and being that upgrade. And Paul Maurice is a great coach. I don't know that he's an upgrade on Barry Trotz. That might be equals. That's a lateral move. But, you know, like Panger said, you know, Barry Trotz can do whatever he wants in hockey. Like he's got those connections. He's got that ability to connect with people. You know, if he wants to do broadcasting, he can do that. And, you know, if he wants to take a couple of years and just recharge, there's no question that he's earned that right. And when he's ready to come back, he'll come back and find the hole that's right for him. But I will say this, the NHL is a lesser place without Barry Trotz in it. And that's my personal opinion.
Well, I think he's a terrific coach, and he's one of the best coaches, you know, from our standpoint to work with. He's terrific to work with in that sense. So we'll see where he ends up, and we'll see where the Islanders go too. One of the names, by the way, you mentioned earlier that I thought of for the Islanders was Mike Babcock. You know, he talks about his relationship with Lou Lamoriello as being very strong. They obviously work together in Toronto. If he's looking to get back in the league and Lou wants to look at him and say, we need something quick, bang, you know, refocus everything here. I wonder if that's a direction he goes in. I don't know. You know, I mean, he's not going to tip his hand to us, put it that way, but that could be something to look at because of a recent history between them.
Yeah, maybe. The two things that would give me pause are, you know, is that the type of coach you need? Do you need a motivator? And two, Mike Babcock's been out of the game for a few years, and I think we can all admit that the game's changed.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that Mike Babcock can't change as well. I think he's a very good coach, but many of the tenets that he built his game on, you know, that the way his teams played, I mean, I can't count how many times they went to a Stanley Cup final and had long conversations about greasy goals and greasy players and greasy play. Unless you're Calgary and Dallas, you're not getting all that greasy right now. So, you know, does he have the ability to kind of take that modern player? Because the players have changed just in 4 or 5 years. Coaching has gone from being a dictator to being a facilitator to explaining to players why. Mm-hmm. Here's what you're going to do, and not just do it. Here's what you're going to do because this is what we need you to do, and I'm going to explain to you why it's happening. And, you know, I think older school coaches are like, I don't need to explain. I'm the coach. I'll tell you to do this. I always explain, Dan, why you have to do bad assignments.
Yeah, you do. You're a very good explainer and things like that. And then I still have to do them.
Exactly. But you feel better about it.
I feel better.
That's what I believe.
Sure. Yeah. I feel better about them until I hang up the phone and then I say bad things. No, I'm just kidding. The thing is, Mike Babcock has been working with some college athletes, you know, in Saskatchewan. So maybe, you know, the teaching aspect of the game has to, you know, you obviously have to be doing the teaching aspect of the game there. So anyway, look, we'll see where it goes. I think we'll know relatively soon what Barry Trotz's decision is going to be and where the Islanders and Lou Lamoriello go. One last thing before we get out of here, Sean, Montreal Canadiens win the draft lottery. They're going to get the number one. They have the number one pick in the draft, and the draft is going to be at Bell Center in Montreal. It all looks so great, right? I mean, the fans are going to love this. The pick is theirs. It's everything you want it to be. Except, is this the year that maybe you would trade the number one pick? And can the Montreal Canadiens do that if they have the number one pick and the draft is in their building, in their hometown? I don't think they can. Ken Hughes has already come out and said they're not going to trade the pick. But, Sean, you would know better than me. Is this the year where somebody says, well, if I can get a good haul for the number one pick, maybe I would trade it?
Yeah, no, I think so. I don't think there's a clear-cut number one. You know, Shane Wright would be, I think, the clearer the picks just because he's got a little more cachet, but there's players that are coming up behind him who are ready to challenge for that number one spot, you know, and you say, can they do it? It would be about the haul, right? If you can make a haul with a couple of name players and you get to go up on the podium and have Gary Bettman say, we have a trade to announce to start the draft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's the players that are coming in, and those players are attractive to the fan base. That would be a great theater. So I think you can do it. I don't think you can make decisions for your fan base and for the long-term future of your your team by what plays well on a given night. Like, you're going to decide the whole future of your franchise by the fact that you don't think you can get up and say, we have a trade to announce, because it would upset the 20,000 people that are there for free. They're not even paying to be there, like, because it's going to be poorly received. And in the 3 minutes after it happens, you're going to forfeit the opportunity to better your organization for 10 years. That's crazy talk.
I think it is crazy talk too. But if you were to go in that direction, boy, you better win that trade. You know, like, you better get a haul in that trade that impacts your organization right away. Yeah. It makes those 20,000 fans in the building say to themselves, I'm buying tickets to opening night. You got to win that trade.
They don't really have to worry about that. I know, that's true. Montreal Canadiens. But that does bring up the point that you don't have to worry about it. Let them pick number one, because the Devils won the lottery too, and they got the number two pick. And, you know, they've been right around that 1, 2, 3, 4 range for several years now, loading up talent. And Tommy Fitzgerald, their GM, said, maybe. Yeah, I'm going to trade it. I need a goalie. He doesn't need a goalie. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody to challenge Bernier and Blackwood. I don't know why you trade for a goalie. There's going to be a ton of them available. There's going to be a ton available in free agency between the cap and the fact that teams are double dipping in goalies now. Like, they're going to flood the market. Why are you going to give up such a valuable asset for that?
I agree with that. I do. I also think when you have your guy, it makes a big difference for your team. And you know, I do think that is an important fact. You need two goalies. We see it. Heck, you need three, right? You need three on your depth chart, but you got a true number one. I think it makes a big difference. And yeah, there'll be goalies out there, but if you can go out and get the guy you want, that you've scouted, that you believe can make the big difference in your team, I think you have to. I think you do that, even if it is a goalie. I understand your point of view, but I just view that position and saying, there's not a lot of them, you know. But if you can get one of them, and it costs you the number two pick in the draft, which is not a sure thing, I think you go out and try to get what you believe is more of a sure thing.
So look, the draft's a long way away, and you know there's a lot of playoff hockey that we're going to go through before we get to the draft. It's never too early to start getting ready. Clearly, Dan, you need to get ready because you tried to dump the whole thing on me and have me talk about who the prospects were. So you can listen to NHL Draft Class with Mike Morial and Adam Kimmelman. They did their first mock draft this week. Great to listen to. They also had on Dan Marr. In case you don't know Dan, that's the guy who does Central Scouting. He's the head guy who marshals all the scouts and does the release of the rankings that all the NHL teams use. So, you know, listen to some Draft Class and follow Mike Morial and Adam Kimmelman on Twitter, and stay on two paths, right?
You all can right.
Do the Stanley Cup final and the draft at the same time.
Sean, you're just killing me on the draft stuff. But look, I got some travel coming up here. So I'm going to Pittsburgh tonight. Maybe I will listen to NHL Draft Class with our colleagues, Adam Kimmelman and Mike Morial, to get myself caught up. But before we get out of here, look, Sean, Everyone's heard of Wordle, right? The NHL has their own version of Wordle. It's called the NHL Stanley Couple.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, every day on the road, one of the first things I do is hit that up, try and figure it out. You know, it's a ton of fun. Go check it out at stanleycouple.nhl.com.
The NHL Stanley Couple is presented by Upper Deck. UpperDeckEPAC.com. It lets you buy, open, and collect your favorite hockey cards from anywhere at any time. Get a free pack just for logging on. Visit UpperDeckEPAC.com today. And Sean, everybody out there, enjoy the hockey.